the top players and legends to the very best analysts around the world from wherever the beautiful game is played. This is BTP. Now, we're talking football.
Yes, hello folks. Welcome to Beyond the Pitch. I'm your host as always, Phil Brown. And I must say, absolutely delighted to be joined here with a gentleman by the name of Wayne Barton. Before we get into the discussion here about his fantastic book about Jimmy Murphy, I want to give a special thank you to Dave Murphy and the Poon up at United in Focus who helped set up this interview. I am honoured to do this interview. As most of you know, I'm a massive Manchester United fan. But in the modern era, very few of the stories that make Manchester United what they are get told. And Jimmy Murphy's often lost when it comes to lauding people in the past about Manchester United's identity, about who they are. And the name of the book, of course, is The Man Who Kept the Red Flag Flying. Delighted to have the author of that book here, Wayne Barton, with us to talk about that book and some of the incredible excerpts. I strongly recommend you get this book. We'll give you details on where you can get it. Even if you're not a Manchester United fan, there's so much in here. First of all, Wayne, how's things, mate?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
All good, all good. The man who kept the red flag flying, the first and only, if I'm correct in saying this, officially authorised biography of Jimmy Murphy from his family. Is that correct?
Yeah, there have been a couple of great books about him. Keith Dewhurst wrote one, When You Put on a Red Shirt, but that's more of a memoir of Keith's life and his memories of spending time with Jimmy. And Brian Hughes wrote an excellent biography on Jimmy, but this is the first one, as far as I know, that was officially authorised by his family, and they worked closely with me on it as well. So yeah.
Why did you want to write a book about Jimmy Murphy?
Great question. I've been very fortunate to work with some former United players on their biographies. And one of the themes that's come up in the post-Fergie era has been that idea of, you know, that what is the United identity and how far are they straying away from that? And those are the conversations I've had so many times with some of the former players. And so many times the root of that was Jimmy Murphy, you know. And it was just one of those things where after hearing so much about him, I thought, well, you know, I want to learn more about him as well. I mean, I was aware, you know, everyone's aware of the basics of Jimmy Murphy, aren't they? You know, that any fairly educated United fan, I should say, is aware of what he did. You know, that he stepped in to help out after Munich and that he was a youth team supremo and everything like that. I just thought from the way that everyone was talking about him that there was much more to what Jimmy did and what he offered to United than his modesty sort of told us, really. And that proved to be the case. I mean, you just scratched the surface. And the work that he did was just incredible. I mean, the man, I said it in the book, he is and was Manchester United. And as soon as I sort of stumbled on that knowledge or that belief, it became a passion, really, to make sure that story got told.
You know, I'm a Manchester United fanatic. I have been since I was a child. And I must admit, there was parts of this book where I raised my eyebrows and said, I did not know that. And I think that's one of the beauties of a book, that it not just entertains, but informs. And there's so much in this book that if you think you're a United fan and you know everything there is to know about that era, I'm going to guess that you're wrong. Because I've taken so much away from this where there's parts of this book I did not know. I mean, you just said something there, and we'll get into that in a little bit, about Manchester United, the Man United way. And that really was as a result of Jimmy Murphy. I've always believed that was a result of Matt Busby. It turns out I'm wrong. And we can get into that, because Jimmy's often left out when it comes to Munich, when it comes to the aftermath of Munich, when it comes to we know all the main people that are often talked about, but Jimmy often gets left out. Why has Jimmy been done such a disservice with what happened after Munich? Because if you look at the book, Wayne, it's very emotional reading about what Jimmy went through with the, you know, obviously he didn't travel to Munich because of the Welsh national team. He was in his office with a bottle of whiskey and a bunch of oranges, and was a broken man after it. Tell me a little bit about why Jimmy gets left out, and tell me a wee bit about his role in the aftermath of Munich.
It's hard to know where to begin. How and why does he get left out in that narrative? You know, and especially now, you having read the book, and you can see it wasn't just a case of, you know, I mean, even if it is just a case of him having led the team in those few months after Munich until Matt Busby was well enough to return, that almost gets airbrushed from history, doesn't it? You know, the fact that he kept them going. I mean, even that part, I mean, I was fortunate enough to take part in a documentary that Bill Rice was recording for BBC just before, you know, in commemoration of the disaster. And I went down to Media City in Salford and spoke to Bill, and I spoke for about an hour. And I think there's about 30 seconds of my talking in there about Jimmy. And I'm not saying that, you know, I didn't want any more airtime, but that was the net result of everything that was about Jimmy in an half an hour, 35 minute show. And it's ridiculous that, and Bill did a great job, by the way. And I think the idea is that there's so much to do with everything that happened. And if I'm to put my finger on a reason for why Jimmy's story is downplayed so much, is because he survived. And, you know, there's so many people who died. Maybe that's the reason why. And you tend to look back at those who, you know, lost their lives and what they could have achieved. And then what came out of that, the actual spirit rather than the people. Because, I mean, you talk about the team that was left behind as well. How many people do people know from that? I mean, they know Bobby Charlton, they know Harry Gregg, they know Bill Foulkes, but not many people know Shea Brennan. They don't know Alex Dawson, who scored all those goals in, you know, after those people were lost, and he kept that team. You know, he scored the goals in that show in the FA Cup run after that. So it's crazy, and I do think maybe it is only because he survived and that there were so many people who were tragically killed. You know, maybe that's the reason why Jimmy's work is, perhaps, or Jimmy's name isn't mentioned as prominently as it undoubtedly should be, because it should be, shouldn't it? I mean, what he did and how he did it. I mean, people have been asking me, well, you know, it's one of the questions, how did he do it? And I don't know. How can anyone know how somebody has that kind of resolve to do that? Because that's, and it's the thing I keep coming back to, is it's not a sporting thing, it's a human resolve. How does someone come back from that sort of tragedy and carry on in the way that he did?
We'll paint a picture of everything that he did after Munich in just a second, because there's going to be people listening to this that aren't sure what we mean by that. But did you detect when you were talking to the family that it was a bone of contention with them that Jimmy has been airbrushed out of the way the narrative is described today with Munich?
I think Jimmy Jr. is certainly I think activist might be the right word for it, actually, in terms of getting his, making sure that Jimmy's not forgotten. Yeah. And it's not so much that they think that people are downplaying him, it's just to make sure that the memory's kept alive, you know, and I guess that's where I come in. And people like me, you know, there are a lot of supporters that have said some great things in the wake of the book coming out. And the best thing that they normally say is about having a statue there statue on the Old Trafford forecourt somewhere for education purpose, you know, for the next generation. And not so much to blow Jimmy's trumpet, but just to make sure that people are aware of what he did, because he's as important as any of those people who've got statues, really. And, yeah, and the family, it's a very interesting thing to think about, because the family, it's not so much that they are upset, they just want his name more prominently known. Or not that they want it, they just wish that it was. And so it's up to like people like us to talk about it, you know, and make sure that education is carried forward.
Do they feel that the club has done enough, Wayne, to acknowledge Jimmy's role in this? How have United themselves dealt with the family?
United get a lot of criticism, don't they, for how they handle a lot of things. And I will say from my research and everything that I've done, all the communication that they've handled, that I've found, that I've been able to get my own eyes on and see how they've handled with that documentation and correspondence with Jimmy, it tends to be referred to people who knew Jimmy within the club. So whether that's
Bobby Charlton or...
Or even Cliff Butler, you know, the statistician, he knew him. So correspondence gets referred to these people. And when you think about it, that is treating Jimmy differently, isn't it? He's saying Jimmy's a special case, and so we'll refer correspondence to people who actually knew him to respond. And one of the things that was said to, I think it was a member of the public who wrote in and said, Jimmy should have a statue. And the response was from Ken Ramsden. And he said, having known Jimmy, I don't think he would have wanted a statue.
It's not about that, though.
Exactly, because that's my argument, because that's the other thing is that, funnily enough, the resistance that I had initially talking to the family when I first floated the idea of getting them actually involved and on board was, they said, oh, he wouldn't have wanted the fuss. And I said, well, with all due respect to Jimmy, people who do great things will have it done on their behalf. And that's what we're here for. And that's where, that's my difference with the club. I do think the club have done what they think is right. I mean, they've got the training centre at one of the buildings at Carrington named after him, which ironically is the one used for media and Jimmy being publicity shy as he was. It just seems ironic. And they've got a bust at the museum, and they've got the Young Player Award is named after him. So they do all these little things. And that was a thing that Fergie actually championed for in the immediate wake of his death, is to make sure that there was something there. So that was set up soon after he died, you know, the Young Player Award. So it was, they did something to act on that and to make sure that his legacy lived on in that way. But there should be more. There should be more. And that's not to say the club haven't done enough. I just think that we're in this age of awareness now, and we're the last generation of people, aren't we, that we are lucky enough to hear the stories of people who lived and worked and enjoyed careers with those who lived around that time. And sadly, they're going to pass away in the next 10, 15 years. So it's up to our generation to keep that memory alive. And I think that's where the club need to act, really. Not that I'm criticising them in any way. Just I think that the time has come to act on it.
I completely agree with you in that, that it is up to our generation. And also, look, when you want to tell the story of Manchester United and you want to talk about identity and you want to know why Mourinho's held to a different standard than many other managers, you have to tell the story of Jimmy Murphy. Because the standard that Mourinho's held to today, with what United are expected to perform every week, is based on the foundations that Jimmy Murphy laid at the football club. Jimmy Murphy, of course, was Matt Busby's number two. And, of course, he took over in the immediate aftermath of Munich, and he played a monumental role. As we had mentioned earlier, he didn't board the plane to Munich because, or to Belgrade, and then on to Munich because of his commitments with the Welsh national team. He goes to the hospital in Munich, and there's a very, very touching story in here about Duncan Edwards and poor Duncan's watch, and some of the Jimmy's. You can only imagine the grief and trauma that Jimmy would have been suffering at this time. He goes into the hospital. Why don't you tell me a little bit about the story you cover in there about Duncan Edwards and Jimmy, of course, going out onto the stairs and breaking down. Tell me a wee bit about that story, because that actually was very emotional for me.
Yeah, and it is. It was one of the most difficult passages of the book to go over, really, because, I mean, you can feel everything in that. Duncan was given a watch by the Real Madrid hierarchy for a gold watch as a sort of memento for how well their relationship had been, really, in the previous year's meeting. And he treasured that watch, and he took it everywhere with him. And it was obviously with him when the disaster happened. And even thinking about just the watches, it makes you emotional. The fact that, I mean, the watch was badly damaged in the wreckage, and it got disassociated from Duncan's body, and he thought it had been stolen off him. In his confusion, where he'd obviously been badly injured, he thought it had been stolen off him, and they eventually found to watch, and the nurse, one of the nurses, brought it to Jimmy. Jimmy hadn't long arrived in the hospital, and I don't even think he'd seen Duncan yet. And the nurse came up to him and said, "Duncan has been asking for this watch, and this is it." And basically, apologetically, handed Jimmy this mangled wreckage of what used to be this gold watch. And so Jimmy went in to see Duncan, and the first thing he's obviously doing is asking about this watch. And oh no, that's not right. Sorry, that's obviously the story that goes with Duncan, and he was talking about that to the other people. But Duncan was in slipping in and out of his coma at the time, and so Jimmy went in and carefully placed the watch on his hand, on his wrist, and I think that was what woke Duncan up. Where, you know, where there's a famous line of "What time's kickoff on right. on Saturday, Chief?" And Jimmy's obviously, he would have been fighting back the tears to say, you know, 3 o'clock. And obviously the aftermath of that is that Jimmy, so distressed was he by what he'd seen. And even it's just such a poignancy in him giving him back the watch. And, you know, even though the watch was broken and giving it back to its owner and that kind of thing is so heartbreaking. And then Jimmy, obviously affected by it, went into the stairwell of the hospital, and he was found by Harry Gregg and Bill Foulkes at separate times, crying with his head in his hands. And, you know, I think the weirdest thing for me out of all of that is that Jimmy knew how badly injured Duncan was. And yet, I don't know where this belief comes from or why I believe it, but I think the actual thing that motivated Jimmy to carry on was the idea that he could build a team around Duncan. You know, that Duncan was still fighting and that Duncan would be all right, because he thought Duncan would overcome anything. Even though all logic, he was a logical man, he was a reasonable man, and he would have seen Duncan. And he would have probably known in his heart of hearts that he wouldn't make it, or that he was at least too badly injured to play again. But part of me believes that the reason why Jimmy carried on was that he could build a team around Duncan, you know, and that would be the symbol of hope and everything like that. Because, you know, obviously there's the line that comes soon after Duncan passed away that Jimmy said, "This is the final blow."
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And it's such a definite line, isn't it?
Which I think also paints a picture of just how good Duncan Edwards was. And a lot of the younger fans, of course, I mean, I wasn't obviously alive whenever Duncan was playing, but I've heard stories of, you know, we've all heard about how good he was. And I think, to put it in a modern context, it's maybe a 21-year-old Cristiano Ronaldo dying in his bed. You know, these were human beings. Bear in mind, at the time, United's biggest wage was £17 a week, and compared to Real Madrid's, it was £800 a week. We'll get into that in a minute, because I want to talk about, in the aftermath, United have to put a team together. Of course, next game's against Sheffield Wednesday, 3-0. A lot of clubs are willing to help. At the time, the only foreign players in Britain were Irish players with Republic of Ireland passports, of course.
Yeah.
An opportunity arises where Ferenc Puskás wants to sign for Manchester United. And there's two problems. First of all, it's against the ethos that Jimmy didn't think it was in United's identity to go sign foreign players. And also, there's the financial aspect where United's top wage was £17 a week. He ended up going to Real Madrid for £800 a week, which gives you an idea of the gap between these two football clubs and how they're paying. Jimmy didn't feel that Ferenc Puskás was right for United. Is that correct?
Yeah, technically it is. There's also the slightly interesting subplot to that is that before the disaster, Jimmy was a big fan, and part of his education in coaching was his good friend Jimmy Hogan, who was the Hungarian coach, who we befriended in the late 30s. So he saw a lot of the great Hungarian side and how they were going to be coached and evolved. And so he had a keen eye on that, and he was a big fan of Puskás. And I think that sometime before the disaster, just after the uprising, when all the Hungarian players were allowed to leave the country and sign for foreign clubs, I think there had been a conversation between him and Busby about the idea of it, and Jimmy would have been in favour of signing Puskás at that time because he absolutely loved those players. So if Busby would have said yes at that time, I think it might have been a very different story. But in the aftermath of the disaster, I think, yeah, there was a lot of red tape, of course, as you already mentioned there. And I think Jimmy just decided it wasn't worth it. And what a monumental decision, because, I mean, what he ended up doing, I mean, you spoke about the players that were offered and the players. I mean, United went into that game against Sheffield Wednesday and they only had two players that they signed. Do you know what I mean? Then they still had nine of their own players to put together, which was extraordinary anyway. But when you think that, I mean, that offer was put to Jimmy and he thought, he considered it and he decided, no, we're going to do this the way that we've always done it. What a monumental decision, what shaped United unbelievably. I mean, because, I mean, 10 years later, they play the European Cup final and, again, it's comprised majorly of you know, homegrown players again. And he could have easily, and there would have been no criticism gone his way if United had played Sheffield Wednesday and they would have lined up with 11 players signed from other clubs, would they? It would have been completely understandable for him to have done that.
It's very admirable that in times of adversity, you stick to your principles. Because most people abandon their principles in those times of need. I want to ask you, and this is an opinion, do you think 1968 happens without Jimmy Murphy?
No. And it's hard to... Oh, what a great question. But I think, again... You're unraveling a few things. So let's just imagine that, you know, I know what you're saying without Jimmy Murphy, but let's assume that he's still at the club and and that the disaster still happens. And there are two key things to come out of this. Obviously, Sir Matt asked Jimmy to keep going on. And I'm not sure. We all know, I mean, from the stories and all the recollections and everything like that, Busby wasn't aware of how severe the damage was back in Manchester.
Yeah.
So how did he know what he was asking Jimmy to get himself into? He didn't know. He didn't know who died. He didn't know anything. For all he knew, nobody had died, and the only person injured was himself. So he was asking Jimmy to do something. If Matt Busby had known what he was asking Jimmy to do, he wouldn't have asked him to do it. That's my belief. The other thing is, Jimmy then took that on, as noble as he did, and he carried on. If once Matt had come around, and there's a story in the book, and obviously other accounts of this as Matt Busby as well, Matt was dealing with the grief of, you know, why did we do this, and I don't want to go back, and he had to be talked into by his wife into coming back to manage United. Would he have done that if Jimmy hadn't carried on? I don't think he would have. If Jimmy hadn't carried on, would Bobby Charlton have come back and played for United? I don't think he would have done. You know, because Bobby had to be talked into playing as well, and that was Jimmy who did that. So there are two massive components of that. And if Jimmy, as he understandably could have done, had said, this is too difficult for me, what would have happened to United? Because there wouldn't have been a cup run. They might not have been relegated. But the essence and the spirit of everything that was achieved in those 3 months at the end of the 58 season would be gone. And without that, you know, United would have been in free fall, understandably so. So, I think not only 68 wouldn't have happened, but I mean, you're talking about very different trajectories for Busby, Charlton, Jimmy himself and the club itself as well.
And quite possibly the Manchester United we see today, because one of the things that you said earlier, Wayne, that I want to touch on, the Manchester United way was a result of Jimmy's ideals, Jimmy's way of playing. This was down to this, we're bringing through youth players, playing with width, playing attacking football on the front foot. This is, according to you in the book, this is Jimmy Murphy's, this is down to him. So what we see today, you attribute this to Jimmy?
Yeah, I do. And let me elaborate on that, because I mean, because that's such a catch-all statement, isn't it? It's like, oh, of course you're going to say that because you wrote Jimmy's story and you're going to credit him with all these great things. So if we go back to, I mean, Nobby Styles described Jimmy as the nuts and bolts of Manchester United. And what he meant by that was that he put everything together in terms of the philosophy. Now, Matt Busby's philosophy, and I should point out right at the outset of me saying all this, is that nothing should be taken away from Matt Busby. And this isn't an attempt to say anything that he doesn't deserve any of the credit that he got, because he was as responsible for the idea of putting a youth team in place and making sure that United played with youth players. He was, his ethos was to entertain the manual labourers and the warehouse workers of Manchester on a Saturday. Do you know, he wanted to give them something in Technicolor to enjoy on a Saturday at the end of their hard weeks, which meant in attractive, flowing football. And so he employed Jimmy to be the guy who worked with youth players for that. Now, what Jimmy did on the youth side of it, and why it was working so well, let's say sort of 55, 56, they had all these rough, raw players that they'd obviously scouted from around the country, players that they'd seen enough in terms of potential to say that they're going to make it, and also in the character to say that they're going to fit in with the other lads. And Jimmy would spend, I mean, the stories in there are of legend, aren't they? I mean, the only player that the only two players he says that he didn't coach were Duncan Edwards and George Best. And there are the stories of, I mean, even those two players would probably tell you otherwise if they were here to talk about it. They would say, no, Jimmy coached us lots, you know, apart from George Best, who he told it. There's a great line from George Best, even though, I'm sorry, I'm getting off track, but George Best said, everyone said Jimmy Murphy was a great coach, but I don't know that because I never saw him. But there's a great story, and I think it is in the book, where after a youth game, and I think it was a friendly game, and George had probably scored about 6 or 7 goals, and it was a massive game. And a massive win for United, not a massive game, it was a nothing game. And it was at a cliff. And after the game, Jimmy was walking around with George on the pitch, frog marching him, telling him all the things that he did wrong. And this is, I mean, you know what I mean? So yeah. What we're saying is, like, you know, so George would have probably said, oh yeah, I remember that, and he did give me some valuable advice, and Duncan Edwards would undoubtedly have said the same about Jimmy. There are stories of, you know, Bobby Charlton, he was learning, you know, he was hitting misplaced passes on the field, so he was having him back on a Sunday morning to make sure that Bobby understood the value of an accurate pass and thinking about the pass that you were going to make. He had him on the back of the Stretford End kicking with both feet to make sure that he was good. And Bobby Charlton, obviously, he became renowned for scoring with both feet from long range, the direct result of Jimmy's personal coaching. And other things like he had Bobby Charlton in some games working as a linesman to educate him about the offside law and things like it, just things that you wouldn't even think of, you know, for coaches with young players, that would be innovative in this day and age. So for him to be thinking about that 60 years ago, it's incredible to have that foresight. And he was doing this with all of these players. There are stories of him running onto the pitch. If he thought that the games weren't competitive enough, he would run onto the pitch and slide tackle players and take them out to toughen them up. There's a great story of Mark Pearson, one of the lads who came in after Munich. He actually got up and he went back in on Jimmy. And then when he realised who it was who tackled him, he apologised to Jimmy. And Jimmy said, no, no, don't apologise. That was great, but don't do it again. Like, I was coming to get you. And this is what he was like. He was toughening them up so much that, I mean, the players were probably dreading it, the 16 and 17 year olds, but by the time they got to the reserve team, the Central League, which was comprised of these young upstarts and old senior pros who were a bit bitter at coming towards the end of their careers, they were good enough to take on those players. Do you know, and And this is where it differs from the modern age, is that those players then had a couple of years at Central League level. You know, one player has one good youth team game these days and one good reserve team game, and they're being called. Look at Adnan Januzaj, for example. He's the perfect case. They're thrown in because there's all this hype around them. Whereas back in the 50s, that he obviously had like a season or two to put them in the Central League and get them ready, so that when they went into the first division in the United team, they were already ready to win. And it's not only that. I mean, it's not only just one or two players. They had seven or eight in the first team, and they had the seven or eight in the Central League, and then seven or eight in the youth team as well. They had such a long, I mean, if not for Munich, it's difficult to tell where that cycle would have ended, because it was perennial, the way they were going on about it.
For me, one of the great achievements of 68 was the fact that Matt Busby, 10 years after losing his team, not just the football side of it, I'm talking about the mental side of it, because this was an era before we talked about mental health, and we all know what the old British mentality was: stiff upper lip, just get up and get on with it, you're gonna be all right, here's a beer, you're fine, don't worry about it, don't talk about this stuff, no, men don't cry, and you have to get on with it. I can only imagine that Matt Busby inside must have been dealing with horrendous grief, horrendous tragedy, a broken heart, and yet somehow raised himself to bring United to a European Cup final 10 years later. How badly do you think Munich affected Jimmy Murphy in the years afterwards? Because the outlet for this wasn't what it is today.
No, you're right. His son Nick says that he had a crucifix that he wore thin with rubbing it. He actually wore the crucifix down to like a small nub. He was that.
Wow, that's
Jimmy,
incredible.
I know, and Jimmy Jr. I don't even know if I put this in the book, because Jimmy Jr. told me not to, and but I'll say it anyway. Along with the stories of him being found in the stairwells of the hospital, Jimmy Jr. doesn't have many recollections of seeing his dad at home around that period, apart from seeing him late at night, kneeled by his own bed, crying with his head in his hand, rubbing the crucifix. And obviously, you spoke about Sir Matt, and yeah, he had the grief and everything, but what they were both living with was guilt.
Yeah, survivor's guilt.
And can you imagine? Grief is bad enough, but living with guilt on top of that is, and as misplaced as it absolutely was for both of them. And they were both living with that. And I think the best thing for Jimmy was that he had something to throw himself into straight after. He actually physically and literally used those lads and those people who lost their life, he used them as motivation to keep going. And he was quite blatant about that. And it was emotion and that raw emotion and grief that got them through that period. Ultimately, though, they were fairly young compared to Sir Alex. I mean, who went on until he was 570. But these guys were 60 when they retired. So they were fairly young by modern standards. But that was 60, and what's the emotional toll? I mean, 80, 90, with the things that they've actually been through. So they'd lived through a decade of that, and this is why I always think of Wembley in 68 as the culmination of what they'd done. It was very much a thing of, I mean, it's no surprise that Busby retired 6 months later. He announced his first retirement, that he was gonna call it a day, because it was very much trying to do that for the memory of those that had been lost. And it's just remarkable that they did that, to be honest. But
Incredible. It's incredible to think of that, and to think what they went through just a decade before. The fact that they even were able to go back to the club and find it within themselves to continue to manage, and it is incredible. We're coming to the end of this, Wayne. There's so much stuff that I'd love to cover. How do you think Jimmy would view what he sees if he was alive today? How do you think he would look at Manchester United today? Do you think he would be happy with what, this is opinion, of course, with what the football you need to play today?
Are you talking under Jose Mourinho specifically?
Correct.
Do you know what? I've thought about this and I've been asked it a couple of times. And I do, I mean, all things considered, we've got to appreciate how different the game is. I mean, when we talk about, I mean, Fergie's success at the side, I mean, and it was a great success of bringing those youth players into the side, and that was four or five players. Do you know what I mean? That was, that was, in terms of what we've seen in the British game since the Busby Babes, that's unparalleled. Four or five, six players. So it's very difficult because, I mean, then you fast forward another 25 years to where we are, and again, the game's progressed so much that, you know, bringing in one or two young players is considered a, you know, remarkable thing. So how many of the top teams have that? I mean, I'm not sure if Liverpool have any, but City don't. They've got the token players that they bring into the squad. Arsenal have Wilshere still, who's there, you know, Wilshere 27 or whatever he is. Chelsea, obviously, despite that. I mean, Chelsea, if they had won the Youth Cup this year, they would have matched Jimmy's record of winning five in a row. And what have they got to show for it? So you've got to take all these things into sort of the perspective of the modern comparison as well. And it's easy to say that these older heads wouldn't be happy with what they're seeing because it's not always entertaining. But I think that considering, and like you said earlier, that the microscope that's put on Jose Mourinho is different to other clubs as well. So he's not only dealing with the responsibility of bringing in young players, and let's be right about this. And I was an advocate for Jose getting the job, by the way, back in 2013. Back in 2013 and back when he got the job. But even I found it laughable when he pulls out that list of 50 players that he brought, you know. Okay, but what he's done at United, because United are different to other clubs, so you can only judge the managers and everything, what they do at United. And he has at least, he's coming round to certain ways. I mean, would Jose Mourinho, and let me ask you this, if you see what you think, 3 years ago, Real Madrid, whenever he was at Real Madrid or at Chelsea, can you imagine him playing a rookie midfielder of all positions who's only played 10 games in one of the biggest games of the season like he did for McTominay? I don't think he would have done that at other clubs. But And you know, like McTominay had only played 10 games, and he played him in a crucial game against Chelsea, and it looks like he'll play against Liverpool as well. And that's not something that you associate with Mourinho. There are other things that he could do better with that. I mean, if there's one thing that I wish he would have learned is the Palace game last season, which was such a throwaway game, and he put all those kids in, but the atmosphere was so good, and the thing that I wish he would have taken away from that was that Old Trafford will get behind those kids and you will get a better atmosphere and they will be willing to let those kids make mistakes. They're more patient than what he gives them credit for.
You know, I think this is a generational thing, Wayne. Yeah. I think guys of our generation, when we see young kids come into the team, because this is the Manchester United that we grew up with, this is in keeping with United's culture, we get behind these kids. But sadly, what we see today with a lot of the younger generation, the likes of Jesse Lingard getting slaughtered, we see Marcus Rashford hasn't scored enough goals, and you know what, Scott McTominay is not the next Ronaldo, therefore he shouldn't be playing for United. And so you get this disconnect between social media where young people, you know, today, and I'm as guilty of it as anybody, where we vent immediately after games when we're, you know, and then you look at it through a different lens an hour later and you're like, God, I can't believe I just said that. But I just think it's really difficult to get an accurate opinion on fans and the way they look at the club today in social media, because so much of it is knee-jerk and so much of it is not thought out. But I think there is a disconnect between the younger fans and the older fans who look at United slightly differently. And we look at Manchester United from a completely different context because we grew up in an era watching United before it was monetized the way it is now. It was about football. And I just think the younger kids today, they're playing FIFA, they're playing video games, their loyalty is a little different. But yes, I agree with you on the whole that, look, United fans will forgive a lot. And if you give these kids a chance, there's very few things more pleasing in football than watching one of your own kids come through the ranks and make it in your first team. I mean, I would always prefer that over a signing. I mean, I would always prefer one of our own kids coming through. And in an era when there's no loyalty anymore, it is nice to see your own kids coming through where there's an immediate assumption of trust between you and that player that he gets the club and not going to leave the first time someone dangles a carrot. So yes, I do like to see that at United. And Mourinho does deserve credit for that because he didn't really do that at Chelsea either, and he didn't do it at Real Madrid. So perhaps it is some of him adjusting to this is the way we do things here at Manchester United, and if you want to survive, this is how you have to do things. So he does deserve credit, and I just hope this weekend we see a good performance. We don't see a scrappy one. No, I just want to see. Although in these games we only ever remember the result, but I want to see United win this weekend. Wayne, on the book, a couple of things. You work. You can get it online, right?
Yeah, all good retailers, Amazon, over here in the UK, you got WH Smith, who are doing a good value deal on it at the moment. Waterstones, and also the publisher themselves will ship worldwide. That's at sportmediashop.com.
Last question on this. How important was this story for you to tell?
I believe before I wrote it, it was the greatest untold story at United.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant line. I'm going to use that. You just got my headline for this interview. So you felt it was the greatest untold story that at Manchester United?
And I think that was vindicated by. I mean, the most worrying thing for me was having the story out there because I do believe that without Jimmy, there'd be no United as we know it. The thing that I did strive to mention is that to make sure it was relatable for modern audiences was that his influence is felt in our present successes, and the idea that he would carry on and that the playing in European football, for example, was something that, those lads who died, they cherished, and they were striving to prove themselves, and that it meant everything to them, and that United carried on and everything, and that Jimmy wanted them to carry on, and then they went and conquered Benfica at Wembley and everything like that. That it's such a great thing that I was fortunate to speak to Sir Alex, who gives a great line in the book, and he says, telling young players what Jimmy did is the most important thing you can do for any young player representing Manchester United. And I defy anyone to tell me that that's not present in the club's greatest night in Barcelona in 99. That's the very essence of not giving in and fighting for something greater. I mean, let's not pull any bones about it. I'm not quite Paddy Crerand sycophantic on saying that United played crap, brilliant when they played rubbish. But let's be right. When we played Bayern at the Nou Camp, they could have been out of sight before
I
injury
know.
time. They,
Basler hits the
and
post and Janka
yeah,
hits the bar and
exactly. And they were much better than us on the night, and there was something there, and that was the spirit of never giving in, and something greater that transcends sport, which is why I love United. It's why I mean, it's present again on, not in the same way, but on Monday night. I mean, we were rubbish in that first half, and then is that moment where not even that moment, the entire 45 minutes where we just went hell for leather, regardless of the consequences. Even Jose Mourinho saying we might as well lose this one 4-0 as win it, and that's quintessentially United to me, and that's what I want to see more of.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And it's funny, if you observe your behavior from a third party and look at a 41-year-old man, in my case, in my opinion, or in my case, 41-year-old man going absolutely crazy over a goal in a football match, and I've got people, of course, in this country who don't get United, looking at me going, "You are a lunatic." But I haven't changed from when I was 16, 15, 14. It's still yeah. elicits exactly the same emotion. And yes, none of it makes sense, but it all makes sense. And Manchester United are still, whilst I've evolved, my love for United has not. And this is a brilliant story to tell, and it helps add another thread, a much needed thread, to the story of this magnificent football club and why we love it. And, you know, I'm sure it's the same for you, Wayne, but when I fell in love with Manchester United, they were not the dominant team in England. It was not a glory hunting exercise. There was just an aura about Manchester United that was so different to anybody else. The red, white and black, I fell in love with them from as a child. And the glamour that surrounded United, even back then, when they were, you know, we were perennially frustrated with Liverpool, and it that hasn't changed. And it's brilliant to get this from a Manchester United fan's point of view, to get much more context to the story about what happened after Munich. And I'm glad that someone has taken the time to write this. This took you 3 years to write, I believe. Is that correct?
That's about how long it took to do that and the research and everything like that.
Good.
It's probably a little bit shorter in terms of the actual time, but the period of time, you know, is easily 3 years, yes.
3 years of a labour of love, because I've no doubt that you will not make hundreds of millions off this book. And I understand you're donating some of the proceeds to charity, is that correct?
Yep, I'm not quite sure, you caught me off guard with the name of the charity, but there's it's for children locally to where Jimmy lived. It's something that Jimmy Jr. has actually named the charity, and we'll be sending some of the proceeds there.
Folks, if you are a football fan, a Manchester United fan, I don't care who you are, this is a brilliant, brilliant story. It's a wonderful gift for somebody, if someone in your family is a United fan or a football fan. This is well worth downloading, buying, and I can tell you, very few books captivate me about Manchester United, because usually it's regurgitation of stuff that I've already read somewhere else. This book, like I said in the beginning, educated me to the point where I found myself turning pages going, I didn't know about that, or previous assumptions on incidents that I had wrong. So if you're a United fan, you think there's nothing else to learn about the football club, I highly recommend you pick this book up. It's exceptionally well written, and it's very easy to understand. So, Wayne, thank you so much for joining me and explaining the book. Thank you so much for writing this book. And, you know, it's just brilliant to see unsung heroes getting some of the coverage they deserve, because Jimmy's modesty shouldn't result in him not being given the acknowledgement that he deserves. So great job on doing this.
Thank you. And no, I absolutely agree about it. There's no accolade that Jimmy, just to repeat what I said earlier, no accolade he could be given that is too great, in my opinion. He's up there with, I mean, you mentioned Busby, you mentioned Ferguson, his name sits alongside those easily.
It should do. So, like we said, the greatest story, greatest untold story surrounding Manchester United. Wayne, I'd love to get you back sometime, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. And I'll be in touch, mate. All the best.
Thank you. You take care, mate.
Cheers, pal.